Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shadi here, your hosts for this weekend show, also your hosts on our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and Substack page. Just search the KE Report. That's where you can hear the full weekend show, as well as all our market updates throughout the week, covering market moves and economic data, as well as company updates, which, again, it's been a very busy summer. A lot of companies out there doing stuff. A lot to follow up in, especially in the commodities sector, and that's the focus of this weekend show. We're going to be focusing on more of the metals in the first half of the show as we're chatting with Rick Rule. And in the second half of the show, moving over to the energy sector, oil and natural gas with Joseph Schachter. A lot of good information coming on this weekend show for all of you, the active investors in the resource space. Without further ado, Rick, welcome back to the show. Rick is the founder of Rule Investment Media and the founder of Battle Bank. Rick, I want to start off more broadly discussing this commodities bull market. I don't think anyone can argue that we are in a commodities bull market. We've seen gold do well. We've seen base metals do well. And we've seen some of the other smaller metals also do pretty well. But again, when you have gold and copper doing well, that really carries a lot of commodities. It's actually been energy that's been slow, but focusing mostly on metals, gold bottomed back in late 2015 at around $1,000. It's been going up for pretty much 10 years. Key breakout happened last year in 2024. And copper, it's broadly, I think, revalued post-COVID into a much higher trading range. So, Rick, what can you say about this commodities bull market?
I would say, importantly, that it's two bull markets. There is a precious metals bull market, which I think has different fundamentals than the commodities bull market. I think the commodities bull market is also more vulnerable, as the energy complex price quotes would suggest. More challenged because the commodities market itself is very vulnerable to a global economic slowdown. I'm not suggesting we're going to have one, Corey. And I would suggest that we will, in the next 10 years, experience a commodities bull market that will likely take investors' heads off. I mean, a really, really, really explosive commodities bull market, really around supply shortages, themselves a consequence of three decades of underinvestment in commodities. I think the bull market in precious metals, however, is already underway. And I think the underpinnings of the precious metals bull market are different from the underpinnings of the commodities bull market, in the sense that, in my experience, precious metals bull markets are first and foremost a reflection of investors' and savers' fear around the maintenance of their purchasing power in fiat currency denominated instruments, particularly, including on a global basis, the U.S. dollar. The United States is still the domicile of 23% of the world's investable funds. And around the world for 40 years, the U.S. 10-year Treasury has been the bottom line, baseline savings product. And I think the impact of the debt and the deficit and the unsecured entitlement obligations of the U.S. government relative to the size of the federal budget and relative to the size of the U.S. economy, which is the ultimate payor, suggests that fear in the maintenance of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar is well funded. I believe myself, Corey, that the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar will decline in absolute terms. I say absolute, meaning not relative to the Canadian dollar or the euro, but in absolute terms. I suspect that the decline in the U.S. dollar purchasing power over 10 years will be 75%, which is to suggest that $4,000 worth of goods and services today, or put differently, $4,000 today in 10 years will buy you $1,000 worth of constant priced goods and services. And I think really the increase that we've seen in the gold price is a reflection of that. And I'm afraid to say that I think that that increase will continue. That doesn't mean that it'll be stair steps to heaven. I think in the very, very near term, Corey, that the anti-US dollar trade is a crowded trade. Everybody is in it, even, and I hate to say even, but even the Canadian dollar has outperformed the US dollar on a 12-month basis. But I would suspect that, given the challenges that the US dollar faces, that, as I say, over a decade, we lose a lot of purchasing power. Now, when I describe the trade as being overcrowded, I'm talking about in the very near term. And it's important to caveat my caveat by saying if the US Treasury caves into the president and artificially reduces US interest rates, that will be a signal to savers and investors worldwide that U.S. society has no interest in the integrity of the U.S. dollar. If we see that happen, all bets are off with regards to lots of financial markets and the gold market.
Well, Rick, I think the point you make is very germane, that a lot of times people look at the dollar index in relation to other floating, equally troubled fiat currencies and look at where the dollar's trading and look at the trend there. But really, the lack of purchasing power over time is far more germane. And that's not really what's happening in the dollar index. That's what your dollars can buy. And if it's going to be a 75% haircut over the next 10 years, then that just means everything else has to go up in price. Now, we have seen gold reflect that for quite some time. I mean, it was $35. Now it's $3,400, almost $3,500. It hasn't changed. Gold's still a rock. It's still on the elemental table. But the price of gold right now has been great for the gold producers. And the price of silver playing along, you know, up in the mid-38s as we talk. So definitely at a high level historically. When you look at how the sector has developed this year, it's been one of the standout sectors, the precious metals equities along with the metals. Any thoughts on how you've seen the producers responding to Q1 and Q2 earnings? Are we seeing more generalists in the space? And does that bode well for the juniors to keep running along for the ride?
Let's do those questions backwards, because you asked me a bunch of them. I am not seeing generalist investors in the precious metal space yet, which is great news for gold bugs. The market share in the U.S. market of precious metals and precious metals related securities is about 0.5%. Which is to say that 0.5% of savings and investment assets in the biggest single investment market in the world are oriented towards precious metals. Importantly, the four-decade mean, according to J.P. Morgan Chase, actually now 45-year mean market share is 2%. So if the generalist investors come into the space, even to the extent that we return to mean, it suggests that there's room for a fourfold increase in demand for precious metals and precious metals related securities. That is to say that the bull market that we've enjoyed has been a bull market that hasn't taken place as a consequence of the generalist investor coming into our space. This bull market is a textbook bull market in the sense that the first part of the bull market, let's call it the period 2020 to 2022, 2023, was really a dead cat bounce. Gold itself had underperformed and was catching up. The breakout period, as you correctly suggest, occurred in 2023, and the increase in the gold price in 2023 was mirrored by an increase in the production costs around gold and silver. And the consequence of that was that the increase in the gold price didn't increase producers' margins at as fast a rate as people had hoped it would. People, you may recall, were concerned about the fact that the gold price increased, but the gold shares hadn't increased. And that was partially a function of the fact that margins didn't increase, at least concomitant with the increase in the gold price. By 2024, the increase in the gold price had gone on for long enough and had continued to high enough levels that the higher gold price really dramatically increased the cash margins of the biggest and best producers, the hallmark, of course, being Agnico Eagle. And the consequence of that is that leadership in the market changed from the metal itself to the best of the best producers. This has happened in the last three bull markets, precious metals bull markets in my life. And one can reasonably expect market leadership to go from the best of the best to the best of the rest, to the leveraged plays, to the single asset producers, to the developers, and ultimately to the explorers. One thing that's interesting here is that even without the participation of the generalist investor, enough cash is cascading down the quality trail that the high quality juniors who are going out to raise money, and they're going out to raise money like mad, are raising all they need. There is, of course, a discrepancy in the junior market between the high quality juniors and most juniors. Given that most juniors have a net present value, not a market cap, but a net present value of zero, those companies are continuing to have problems raising money. But the companies that deserve to get money have seen a very, very, very different capital markets experience in the last 18 months, and that continues.
Rick, I'd say even in the last about 3 months, we have seen, I think, even more money filtered down the food chain. Some of these companies that haven't had news for years seem to be able to raise money even right now. And it's one of those things where gold price has gone sideways for about 5 months now, and the stocks have played a lot of catch up. I'm sure you hear the same stuff where, look, these stocks are all cheap. We keep hearing how cheap these stocks are, but quite frankly, we have seen a revaluation almost across the board from the big guys to the little guys, especially the little guys in the last few months. But in terms of class of companies within the precious metals, where do you still see the best value now that we have had this catch-up trade?
I think you have to be selective. I don't do it, but one place that we're seeing value is companies that have fairly long reserve lives and mines built so that they won't experience the inflation in mine builds that are selling at low multiples to the net present value of free cash flow, so-called optionality companies. Companies that I have avoided because they aren't in the best half of the cost curve. So I'm thinking companies like Oceana Gold, you know, with 15, 16% free cash margins, long reserve lives, the construction budget behind them. I'm seeing value there. I'm seeing value in the smaller end of the royalty and streaming space, relative value at least. You're seeing the biggest and the best, the Francos and the Wheatons, performing spectacularly well and selling at a premium to ascribed net asset value. You come down the quality trail just a little bit, you know, to the Osiscos, the Triple Flags, those companies. They're selling at substantial discounts on a net present value basis to the big guys. If those valuation discrepancies don't disappear due to value arbitrageurs, make no mistake, the big guys will take over the little guys. And the valuation discrepancies coming down are even more extreme, which is why you saw the Sandstorm recently disappear. So I'm attracted to that. When you come to the quasi-royalty companies, I'm thinking about the prospect generators that rather than taking carried working interest, take royalties. You're seeing at least two of them, Altius and EMX royalties, selling at extraordinary enough discounts to the net present value of their assets that rather than issuing shares to raise money, they're using their own free cash flow to buy in shares. I would suggest as an example that EMX is selling for half the market cap that the sum, that the valuation of the sum of the parts at auction would face. And the EMX management, I think, has decided that the best way to increase net asset value per share, rather than making new investments on the opportunities on offer, are simply buying in their own shares. And I think Altius, with the recent sale of the Walker Lane royalty, has made the same decision. One thing, Corey, that has always amused me is the old Doug Casey quote, which describes the return of capital to shareholders via dividends or buybacks for those companies who can afford it as, quote, outward manifestations of inward grace. And Doug suggested that sometimes in the market, you have a choice between buying companies who are issuing shares, believing that your cash has more value than their shares, and other companies who are using their cash to buy your shares back, believing the shares are more valuable than the cash. One real determinant of a company's real worth is whether it's issuing shares or buying back shares. And I would urge people to look past the narrative and think about that.
Well, Rick, you bring up a great point about as far as how companies are choosing to return capital. Some are buying back shares, some are paying dividends in the producers and even in the royalty space. But the other area that they could invest that would be into growth, organic growth, but also M&A. And so you brought up M&A with Sandstorm being taken over by Royal Gold and how that's taken another one off the board. But do you think we'll see more M&A coming out of this Beaver Creek Denver Gold Forum cycle in about a month and a couple of weeks here, where some of the development stage companies get gobbled up by mid-tiers, or some of the producing single asset producers get picked off? Are we going to see an increase to the M&A that we've already been seeing?
Absolutely. If the valuation discrepancies continue to exist, yes. What we're seeing is reasonable quality deposits at the preliminary economic assessment stage, which is to say where the information presented to us is incomplete and where the timeline to completion is 5 years or longer. We're seeing those companies sell at about 20% of indicated NAV. As the timelines shorten and we go to pre-feasibility study, the discounts are more like 40 or 45% of NAV. At the bankable feasibility stage, those assets might be 75% of NAV. Combined into a single asset producer, that project may be 1.1 times NAV. Combined into a multi-asset producer, particularly a multi-asset producer in a jurisdiction that's perceived as being politically safe. You'll notice I said perceived. The NAV multiple may be 1.5 or 1.6 times NAV. To the extent that those valuation discrepancies persist, I think it makes absolute sense that larger, more liquid companies with lower cost of capital, which is to say a less of a discount or a negative discount to NAV, will take over the other companies. It will be cheaper to purchase at a premium successful efforts using your own stock where you have a lower cost of capital than your competitors do.
Yeah, that strategy makes all the sense in the world just because, well, we've seen how tough it is to build mines. That actually ties into another question. Curious your thoughts on these juniors or mid-tiers that are taking over these old mines, these mines that have bankrupted one, maybe a few companies, but these mines are making money right now. And it's in a way re-rating some of these juniors, but they're no way in the lower quartile of costs. What do you think of this strategy and some of these plays?
I don't think that you can paint all of them with the same brush. I think to the extent that a junior is taking over a producing mine, that you need to look at the management team's track record doing exactly that. An example would be Tony Makuch at Discovery taking over some of the Ontario assets of Newmont. What he is doing is signing up to a task which he has done for 30 years. It makes perfect sense that that asset wasn't germane to Newmont, and that that asset was used as a cash cow to fund other Newmont opportunities, and it didn't get the love, care, and attention in Denver that it might. It's arguable that Tony Makuch will be able to selectively invest capital in that mine that Newmont didn't invest, and that mine will be his focus. And he has focused on the Abitibi and the Canadian Shield his entire career. That type of acquisition makes sense. A different type of acquisition where people are adding assets merely for scale, where they don't have the demonstrated ability to turn the asset around, I think is more problematic. So I think that you need to examine the companies involved in those transactions on a case-by-case basis.
Well, Rick, we've also seen a couple of roll-ups in the silver space. I'm thinking of Gatos by First Majestic, Silvercrest by Coeur Mining, and MAG Silver by Pan American. That takes a lot of the quality off the table and merges it into larger companies, but there's still a rabid interest in silver production. Unfortunately, most silver producers are base metals producers or gold and silver producers. Hard to find that isolated silver-only producer. In that universe, do you see any opportunities in the producers or developers within the silver spectrum?
Yeah, I do. This is my fourth precious metals bull market. And at some point in time, the generalist investor comes into the precious metals space. The price momentum justifies the narrative, and people who are investors in other space come into our space. When that happens, I don't know why it happens, but when that happens, leadership goes from gold to silver and from gold stocks to silver stocks. And these things re-rate in absolutely crazy fashion. There simply isn't enough of a silo in decent quality juniors to accept the money that comes in the space. And they go absolutely berserk. There's a very small population of high quality juniors. I would suggest that, in the producing space, likely Aya, albeit based on current production, it's fully priced based on its pipeline and its track record, likely not. And then Abra and Vizsla. You know, that's a fairly small universe. There are probably some other names, but those are the ones that I'm intimately familiar with. And when the generalist money comes down into the precious metal space, if past is prologue, the silver stocks explode, even the lousy silver stocks. But I wouldn't encourage people to buy lousy stocks as a consequence of people even dumber than them coming down into the space. Looking at the acquisitions that have taken place, a couple of them are easy to explain. In the case of, you know, both Coeur and First Majestic, while they have long track records buying and turning around mines, both of them were, at least in the near term, cash flow deficient. And both of them bought assets that were very accretive to shareholders on a per share cash flow basis. This occurred because both of the assets that they bought, Gatos and Silvercrest, have relatively short indicated mine lives, which means that the cash flow overstates the net present value. Now, I happen to believe in both cases that there's exploration upside. In other words, that these mine lives can be extended. But based on the data, those two transactions were similar. The transactions were accretive on a cash flow per share basis, but they were not accretive on a net present value basis. The acquisition by Pan American of MAG was the acquisition of a uniquely high quality asset at a premium price by a premium issuer.
Interesting breakdown there, Rick. Let's also switch our focus over to copper. Look, copper, I think, has completely re-rated post-COVID. Seems to have a floor right around $4 a pound and a ceiling, well, right now in the $5 and change region, but taking out that tariff spike, copper has kind of been trading in a trading range with a slight upward bias for the last about 3 years. And more recently, the stocks have started to do a bit better. What do you see in the copper space in terms of opportunities?
In the very near term, I'd be scared. Copper is an economically sensitive commodity. And the weakness I see in the oil and gas quote, by the way, I'm really attracted to the oil and gas business. The weakness I see in the oil and gas quote, I'm very afraid, is going to cascade into the copper market. So in the very near term, I'm nervous about that trade for economic reasons. Looking longer term, there's zero doubt in my mind that we're going to have supply shortages in copper. We have underinvested in the copper industry for at least 3 decades, underinvested in exploration, underinvested in sustaining capital, and those chickens are going to come home to roost. The deterioration, the purchasing power of the US dollar that I described is going to raise the price of building new copper mines from high to astronomical. To the extent that you're going to spend $8 billion to build a Chilean porphyry in 2025 dollars, I'm relatively confident that 3 years out, that number will double. So the value of existing producing assets that don't need to be built from scratch is, I think, unrealistically cheap. I believe that you will see financing mechanisms developed over the next 10 years, including, as an example, term contracts in copper, like the term contracts in uranium, that will overcome some of the financial challenges. So the higher quality copper discoveries, I think, will do well, too. But I would be very concerned in the near term for speculators that have a trader's mentality, for people who are looking for, how would you say, capital gains by Christmas. I'd be very concerned about that. I'm happy in the copper space myself because I have a 5-year outlook, but I've come to realize that I'm a different type of speculator. I would note too, Corey, around the whole speculative complex near term, including the speculative gold stocks, that the VIX, the volatility index, is at almost all-time lows, which suggests that there's no fear in the current market. And if you saw the VIX tick up to 20, and you went back to a risk-off trade, even temporarily, you would see in the very near term the juniors getting waxed. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying that speculators, that traders need to keep that thought in the back of their mind.
Well, Rick, one more follow-up on the copper stocks. You've mentioned your propensity to invest in prospect generators, and when you're going after a copper porphyry, the holes are deep and they're expensive, and a lot of juniors try to do it and then fall on their face because they can only drill a few holes and then run out of money and get stuck on the hamster wheel. Do you prefer the prospect generator model for the exploration of copper porphyries and these kind of systems, or a partnership or a JV with a senior versus a junior going it alone?
Absolutely, positively. I prefer the prospect generator, period, full stop, irrespective of the commodity. The truth is, aside from the narrative, that most exploration efforts fail. When I was in university, I learned that 1 in 3,000 mineralized anomalies becomes a mine. So the basic Howe Street value proposition is that you'll have a 1 in 3,000 chance for a 10-to-1 return. Makes the BC lottery look like a good deal. The idea that your exploration methodology is to use your generative and commercial skills to formulate theses which are then tested with other people's money and other people's talents is arithmetically the finest form of exploration finance. In addition, you get off-balance sheet benefits. Not too long ago, I walked through the tech offices in Vancouver, and I was delighted to see about 200 earth scientists. The idea that I generate a prospect, which then tech explores, means I have access to those 200 earth scientists and I don't pay for them. Tech does. So, in every way, shape, or form, I prefer the prospect generator to any other kind of exploration finance technology.
Hey, totally makes sense considering just how expensive it is to explore for copper projects and then also how big of a prize it can be. Rick, thank you so much for your time. I know you are a busy man, so it is great that you spent some time with us on this weekend show to share your thoughts on more of the metals sector. Another offer that Rick has for all of you is he is willing to grade your portfolio. I'll post a link to the Rule Investment Media website. That's where you can get in touch with Rick and share the stocks you hold in your portfolio, and he'll tell you what's good, what he doesn't like, and maybe anything else of wisdom, points of wisdom that Rick can share with you. So, Rick, again, great having you on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Gentlemen, thank you for inviting me back. I look forward to visiting again.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.